Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, well, a very eventful week. A magnitude 5.7 earthquake hit Utah, causing structural damage and power outages. And the earthquake did nothing to calm nerves already frazzled by the coronavirus pandemic. And on that topic, Utah's own Representative Ben McAdams is now the second member of Congress so far to test positive for the novel coronavirus. And joining me for this conversation all via the phone this morning, we have Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. And Matt, thanks for making time for this.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. We've also got from the nation's capital, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thanks to you as well, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. And news columnist Robert Gerke, thanks as well for you being for joining us as well.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for being here. Listeners, you can join this conversation with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. We are recapping an eventful week of Utah news. And as I said, all guests joining via the phone instead of cramming into a small studio, and our audio quality will suffer a little as a result, but we ask for your patience on that front. To the news, Matt Canham, I want to start with the strange way that the alarm clock that woke many people up on Wednesday morning was working. An earthquake unlike any that we've felt here along the Wasatch Front. Remind us when it hit and where it was centered, and then we'll turn to its impact on Utah and on the state's coronavirus response.
It hit at 7.09 a.m., and the epicenter was a couple miles northeast of Magna. It woke people up. It had people running out of their house. It shook buildings. I think the big takeaway out of this, and it's a good one, is that no one died and no one was seriously injured. But a 5.7, it felt serious to me, and I'm sure it felt serious to many of the people who live in this valley.
Actually, before we move on, maybe I'll ask each of you to just recount your own experiences with this. Were you shaken awake? Were you driving? Matt Canham, were you, already at work? How did you live through this?
No, it woke me up, and I knew immediately what it was. And I ran downstairs, jumped on my computer. We're all working at home now at the Tribune.
Right.
And we started communicating. We threw a story together. So I think I posted the first story within 10 minutes, maybe. And obviously, it's very short. And then everyone in the staff just kicked in. So it was great.
Yeah, a lot of bylines on the story covering this big earthquake. Robert Gerke, how did the quake play out for you?
Well, yeah, I was like Matt. I was still just sort of laying in bed. I'd woken up, but you know how you are some mornings. You don't want to get out of bed. You're just kind of laying there watching the ceiling fan, and it started to move. And, it was noisy outside. I live on a fairly busy street, so I thought there was just, a heavy truck rolling by or something like that. And it just kept getting louder and louder. The windows were rattling, and the dogs were having a bit of a tizzy. And so I realized what it was. I froze. I panicked. Wasn't sure what to do. All that training you go through when you're a kid in school in Utah, the duck and cover and all that kind of left me. So, my son ran in, my teenage son ran in and was in a little bit of a panic. Okay, Dad, it's time to go. And I'm like, we're not going anywhere. Stand in the doorway.
Right.
We rode it out. But it was frightening because we were all okay, but you don't know how bad it's going to be outside. Like Matt, I jumped on my phone and was checking seismic stations, checked Twitter to see, things were okay, texted a few people, yeah. Started making some phone calls to try to help what I could to report it. And and to the Tribune's credit and to the media's credit generally, I think it was an admirable job, given the circumstances, of covering two natural disasters, we'll call them, on the same day at the same time. It was an intense and sort of surreal day.
Yeah, without a doubt. Thomas Burr there in Washington, D.C., I know you didn't feel it, but did you get...
I didn't feel a thing.
You didn't feel a thing. You slept right through it. Well, you were probably already awake.
Yeah, I was awake, yeah.
Did you get texts and calls and tweets from Utah saying, hey, this just happened?
Yeah, and so, I checked in with my mom, of course. It's fascinating. I just watching from afar how quickly everyone was jumping in to report the news, and it really was amazing to see, you know, the kind of the public response. No one was injured, you know, thank God, and really, you know, some structural damage, but it shows how people can, even during these two natural disasters, as Kirky called them, you know, people show the best sides of them sometimes.
Yeah. For my part, I'm just going to mention that I was in bed, and I also woke up, got scared, got under a doorway. And then actually in a press conference the day of the quake, I learned that I actually should have stayed in bed. If you're in bed, you're supposed to stay in bed. And then the door frames actually are not the best spot. Better to get under a table or something sturdy, according to an expert at one of the press conferences that day. And I can't remember who it was. But I at least didn't run outside naked like one former Tribune reporter I know. anyway, let's move on to the news. Let's get to what kind of damage we actually saw from this quake. I guess to a certain extent that's still being determined, but the general overview of what this earthquake actually did, Matt Canham, Magna, which was near to the epicenter of the quake, had more significant damage than other places. Is that correct?
Yeah, crews are still going through, Magna, checking buildings one at a time. If you get a green sign on your building, it means you can go in there. If it's red, there's enough structural damage that they're worried about people being safe. There were buildings that shed bricks, and you can see that along the roads. And some of this wasn't actually, you know, some of it was walls. Some of it was more design elements at the top of buildings that didn't make it. But Magna took it pretty hard, and it impacted people's homes. There's cracks on walls or stuff like that. If you go to downtown Salt Lake City, There's the building next to the Mission that was under construction, and it had some structural problems, which shut down the Mission for a while. And I don't know, it might still be shut down, to be honest with you. And there were some multiple places like that. The LDS Temple, they said it had a little bit of brick shifting, but the big damage there was the Angel Moroni lost its trumpet, which was just a kind of, I mean, it's not obviously not a big deal, but it is just a fascinating little tidbit in a story.
Right. I always assumed that it was, you know, connected to or one part of the statue and that it wasn't a separate piece, but it turns out that it is a very separate piece.
Yes.
Here in Salt Lake City as well, the Episcopal Cathedral, the Church of St. Mark's, a 150-year-old building, it was damaged?
Yeah, it has probably more damage than just about anything else. And they're still trying to figure it out. I mean, it has multiple places along the nave and the transept where they're a little worried about the brick shifting. It's an old building. So they're still figuring out exactly what's happening there.
Okay.
They say it's nothing catastrophic, which is nice, but I don't think they're going to be able to hold services there for quite a while.
Okay. We talked about the fact that there were no fatalities or even serious injuries from this quake. There were power outages, though, right, Matt Canham?
Yeah. I mean, when I was tracking, there was more than 55,000. I think our latest story had it over 75,000 power outages. Obviously concentrated in the Magna, West Valley, west of Salt Lake City area, where that really took the brunt of that shaking. And it took all day to get power back on for some people, but the crews worked really fast, and by the end of the day, pretty much everyone was back in power.
And then there was, part of this that we haven't gotten to yet, a chemical plume, the cloud from a chemical leak at the Kennecott Mines refinery. What happened there, Matt?
So Magna's been worried about an earthquake and the impacts being so close to Kennecott for a long time. Their long-time concerns were this tailing pile that could slide down into town. Luckily, it does not appear that anything shifted there. But the earthquake did shift some hydrochloric acid tanks. They hit, and it created this acid plume that went skyward, and you could see it for miles. So all these crews came down there, including the Utah National Guard, and they determined that it wasn't too bad for anyone's health because it just went up, and it was far enough away from residents that they didn't think it had any health effects. But when you are covering an earthquake and you hear that there's a chemical plume, that was an additional level of, you know, fear that added to everything else that was going on. But in this case, it wasn't as bad as it sounded like.
And they got it under control as well, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, and it didn't take them long to clean up the acid. It was a big tank. I mean, it was thousands of gallons of hydrochloric acid, but the actual spill wasn't as big.
You talked about Magna being worried about the tailings mining byproduct above the town, but there's also at the epicenter of the quake is where the tailings pond is, where water that is runoff, that is, right. I guess, contaminated water is held. Was there any news on how that held up?
You know, we didn't hear anything that was a major concern in that area, but to be honest, that's an area where we need to put more reporting heft. We're going to go back and look at Magna and what's happening in that area to see if there was anything that we missed in the chaos of these first 2 days.
Okay. Hey, what about the idea of Matt, I'm just getting lost here for a second, but there was things spreading kind of around on social media in Utah, and apparently news of a bigger quake coming hot on the heels of the first one was a rumor that was spreading around social media. Officials dispelled that kind of quickly, right?
They did, but it's an awkward thing to dispel because they also pointed out you cannot predict earthquakes.
Right.
So the biggest part of that rumor was that saying one was going to come, you can't know it. But you also don't know that it isn't going to come. They said it was a 1 in 300 chance that we would have a magnitude 7 earthquake or above. Now, that's not nothing, but it also has pretty long odds. And so far, we have not had anything of that effect. So the big earthquake we had at 7:09 is still the biggest one among the more than 150 aftershocks since then.
Right.
But yeah, we had people panicking, packing, trying to get away because they thought that a 9-point earthquake was coming. Now, I learned something from watching the experts that day is that because of the way our valley is structured, about magnitude 7 is as high as we're going to get. Now, a magnitude 7 would cause catastrophic damage. It would be far, far worse than what we went through. But what we were hearing is there's going to, be some 9-point earthquake. I had family members texting me, is this true? It went all over the place. And the authorities tried to shut it down as fast as they could.
What about the quote-unquote, big one, that 6.7 or higher, a 7.7, around 7.0 magnitude earthquake that we are supposed to get? That's still out there waiting for us here in the Wasatch Front, right?
Yes, and seismologists at the University of Utah said that this quake increases the odds a tiny amount. But they also, if you look at the forecasts for earthquakes in our valley, a 5.7 fits right into what they told us we were going to have. But they also said we're going to have a big one at some point. Will that be this decade? Will it be in the next 25 years? Will it be longer? We don't know, but they say we are overdue. And Robert wrote a good column kind of encapsulating how poorly we are all prepared for such a disaster, myself included.
Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Tribune, what a time to be alive. What did your observant eyes, see in how we handled this earthquake and our preparedness in general?
Well, yeah, just first, I guess, kind of touch on a couple things Matt said.
Yeah.
We were really fortunate, I think, because, as you mentioned, we didn't see buildings collapse. We didn't see widespread power outages, fires, injuries, deaths, that sort of thing. The state has done modeling on what a 7.0 would look like if we got one that big. And keep in mind, 7.0 is significantly bigger than 5.7 because
right.
of the way the Richter scale works. But they estimated at least 3,500 deaths, a third of hospital rooms wiped out. And another point I made is if we had gotten a larger, more damaging earthquake later in a coronavirus outbreak when hospitals were already taxed or overwhelmed, it would have been a whole different ballgame. So we were, it sounds odd to say, fairly fortunate given what could have been. But it kind of drove home the point. We've seen all this panic buying with the coronavirus, and it drove home the point to me, at least, and others that I know, that we need to be prepared
for that big earthquake when it comes, or for a viral outbreak, or for a flood, you know, and we get told this stuff all the time, just like we're told we're supposed to floss and all of those things, and we don't necessarily do it the way we should. And so I think if nothing else, the message that I took away from this is that, you know, once there's water and toilet paper and beans and rice back in the stores, I'm gonna stock up. I'm gonna get a 72-hour kit with a radio, with, you know, medical supplies and things like that, just because, you know, it doesn't hurt to have. Certainly, if nothing else, it's best case scenario, it sits on your shelf, low shelf, so it doesn't fall off, tip over. But it's something we should all have, and we should all be prepared for, because if this was a larger, more damaging earthquake, we could have been on our own for quite some period of time before power is restored, fires are put out, medical authorities available. So we just need to be prepared for this.
All right, Robert Gergy advocating for preparedness. Just before we head to a break, Matt Canham, one sort of tidbit that I saw this morning that I didn't know. This is the Wasatch Front's largest earthquake on record?
Yes, we tried to find that information quickly. We found that there was a equivalent earthquake in St. George in 1992. The strongest earthquake we could find along the valley here was also in Magna in 1962, and that was a 5.0, and we just went through a 5.7. We couldn't find an equivalent earthquake before that. So, yeah, this is the biggest quake we've all felt, or our grandparents have felt, our great-grandparents felt, and who knows going back how far this has gone.
Right, geologic time is a little bit longer than
that's right,
the human era.
I'm sure there's been one, but it's been a while.
All right, Matt Canham is Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. We are going to take a quick break on the show, and when we come back, the latest on coronavirus in Utah. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined via the phone by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and news columnist Robert Gergy. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW to get caught up on this past week's news and participate in the show. Well, the earthquake in some ways was a distraction, though not necessarily a welcome one, from what has been on our minds front and center, a global pandemic, coronavirus, and the measures that have been put in place to try to slow its spread. I suppose we should start with the latest update from the state health department. They come out with a new tally every day at around noon or 1 p.m., I believe. And so this would be Thursday's update. But Matt Canham, senior managing editor with the Salt Lake Tribune, what are the latest numbers there?
So they still break it out between residents and people who were tested positive when they visited here. Overall, we have 78 confirmed cases. 68 of them are residents. And the biggest clusters are in Salt Lake County, which is the most populous county, and Summit County, which gets a lot of tourists at the ski resorts. Those are the two areas that are taking the brunt of the virus so far. But as we all know, testing has been relatively limited. They did start reporting the number of tests that the state knows about, and that is kind of interesting, too. They have the state epidemiologist, Angela Dunn, said yesterday that 1,526 people have been tested. We only have 78 confirmed cases. That means the majority of people who have a fever and a cough and a tightening of their chest have some other cold or flu-type problem. But that's, she said that's an underrepresentation of the number of tests because some private labs are only reporting their positive tests and not the number of tests they've done. So more than 1,500 tests have been done. I think that's a little heartening, is that of those who even qualify for a test, and for that it's been very hard, you have to have the symptoms, have been in contact with someone known to have had it, or have traveled to an area that had an outbreak, or be in a dire health situation
to receive a test. Is that correct?
To even receive a test, and still the vast majority have not got it. Now, state epidemiologist Angela Dunn also says that number is a vast undercount because lots of carriers have this disease, and they either have very mild symptoms, not worthy of going to get tested, or they have no symptoms at all. And you look at someone like Donovan Mitchell from the Utah Jazz who tested positive. To my knowledge, he has never experienced any sort of symptoms. But he is a carrier, and if he wasn't in isolation, he could be giving it to quite a few people. So far more people have the virus than we know, but it hasn't been as we haven't seen huge skyrockets like they have in some other places like Washington State or New York City.
Right. Yesterday here at KCPW, we did a live Q&A with some infectious disease specialists that I encourage people to check out. They said that we should, though, as you're pointing out, Matt, assume that those numbers are not reflective of the reality, that community spread
right.
is happening out there, and hence we have these social distancing measures in place. You know, I want to get to some of the other repercussions of this pandemic as they're playing out here in Utah, but I want to press the pause for a second and turn to the news from Washington. Well, it's actually not from Washington, but the news that Representative Ben McAdams, who represents Utah's 4th District, tested positive for this virus. And let's bring Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief, into this conversation. First off, you know, I guess the question that I have is, do we know how the congressman is doing? Tommy, we had you down. Go ahead. Continue again.
Okay, there we go. When I talked to the congressman on Wednesday, you know, he called me and he was coughing for the first, you know, like 10, 20 seconds of our conversation, and it didn't sound good. I'm going to check in with him later today, but he's isolating himself at home. He's not so far needed to go to the hospital other than, you know, he went and got tested. And we're not sure how he got, you know, COVID-19. Obviously, the Senate aide told me, you know, Capitol Hill's a petri dish right now. You're in close quarters with a lot of people all the time. The congressman probably, you know, received it somehow in, you know, shaking hands or on one of the flights he takes to and from Washington all the time, that all members of Congress pretty much take. It's a tough situation, but he's just, you know, just quarantining himself at home. His family doesn't have it, and I assume they're pushing, you know, food underneath the door or something.
he issued a statement to, you know, to announce that he had this, and also kind of a warning for people to take this seriously. Can you tell us about that, Tommy?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he's. As I think most members of Congress and elected officials are doing right now, this isn't a joke, and there's very serious, you know, consequences that could happen. So yes, to take this as serious as possible. In his situation, as soon as he returned from Washington Saturday night, he, you know, was feeling, you know, a little off, and, you know, his chest was constricted, and he woke up Sunday morning and he called his doctor, which is what they're telling people to do, which is not, you know, go to an emergency room, not go to a doctor, to call them. They, you know, do FaceTime, whatever you need to do. And then, you know, the doctor said, you know, hold off a little bit. When things got worse, the doctor sent him to get a test. And he's obviously not going to be the only one in Congress who has this. There's a representative, a congressman from Florida, Mario Diaz-Balart, Republican, so this is a bipartisan situation. He has it, but they obviously had contact with dozens of members of Congress, and we still have a lot of things that need to happen here in Washington to help with the situation.
I mean, they both, as you said, both of those congressmen, Representative Diaz-Balart and McAdams, are isolating themselves. Representative John Curtis, you reported, had, you know, was in contact with McAdams last week, and he has contacted his physician. Is he also self-isolating now?
He's I don't know what the term would be if it's self-isolating, but, you know, he's doing social distancing right now. He's trying to be keep his distance from anyone else, but he hasn't shown any symptoms. He's still fine. He's not going to get tested because he hasn't had any symptoms. And again, that he walked to votes with Congressman McAdams on it was actually Saturday morning. It's like 2 a.m. Friday night. They walked to votes together, but that doesn't mean that, you know, they touched each other. There were no, you know, handshakes obviously trying to go on at that time. No other member of our delegation has so far shown any symptoms or has any issues. But we also, you know, Mitt Romney is 73 years old right now. He's going to be very cautious. His wife has MS, so they're being more cautious with her. And we'll see where this goes. But if two members have it, that means four members have it. I mean, you know, 16 members are going to have it soon. It could balloon.
Right. You wrote a story about the fact that Congress serves as kind of the, you know, a perfect vector for the spread of the disease. Can you give us the gist of that reporting, Tommy? I mean, the idea is people, you know, they meet in Washington and they go back home. And I'll let you explain that.
Yeah, sure. And a politician's job is to shake hands, pretty much. That's what they do. Hopefully they don't kiss any babies anymore. But the idea is that members of Congress interact with the public. They interact with each other. And I'm on the Hill a lot. And it's a big complex, but people are kept in very small quarters. And the amount of people you're near is pretty immense. And right now, you know, like the rest of the country, it is symbolic. There, everyone's getting it, but Congress has to do some things. They've already passed two measures to try to help with the response to the coronavirus, and they're looking at now another package, a $1 trillion bill. And Congress has absolutely no ability to remote vote. They can pass things essentially by unanimous consent, voice votes. But if one person objects, in the House, for example, they got to bring back 216 members to actually have a vote on anything. They're taking steps. There's no public tours. The only people allowed in the Capitol now are, members of Congress, essential staff, and some journalists. But it's just showing that it could get worse, and Congress is affected.
You know, I want to get back to at some point the relief package that you just talked about from the federal government and the voting that may or may not be able to happen on that. But this does, as you're pointing out, this points to the fact that this is out there. It's highly contagious. It's spreading. I want to bring news columnist Robert Gierke in on the conversation again and just ask you, Robert, to start with, to comment on Representative McAdams testing positive and, I don't know. And then what that means.
Yeah. Well, with 435 House members, 100 senators, it's not surprising that we're going to see House members testing positive, and especially as Tommy noted in the story, that given that they fly all the time, they're in close quarters, constant handshaking and so forth, it's not surprising. It is unfortunate, and it is you listen to Representative McAdams talk about it, and he says it's like having one of the worst colds he's ever had, which isn't necessarily life threatening, but keep in mind, Representative McAdams is also one of the younger members in Congress, and so he's going to, probably weather this a little better than most or others might. He told me tonight that he got it. I spoke with him briefly, and he said that he anticipates that his wife and children will get it as well. It's sort of an assumption that they will, and they're isolating as well. And so, it's not surprising, but it also sort of it should send a signal to us that we need to take this seriously too. And that's one of the most disturbing things about this is we saw a letter from some rural county commissioners that was written to the governor's office this week, expressing their view that this is overblown, and I think that sends just the wrong message to people at this point. This is as Dr. Angela Dunn said yesterday, this is going to get much worse before it gets better. We're in for, and I think maybe the state set some false expectations in saying that they were going to suspend school for 2 weeks, and that maybe in 2 weeks we would be back to normal. No, we're not going to be back to normal in 2 weeks. And yesterday they drove home that point, saying there could be disruptions through the end of the year into next year. And so we're in this for the long haul. If you look at what's happened in China, if you look what happened in Italy, if you look what happened in Spain and some of these other countries, it's a steep curve, and we're at the very bottom of that curve, and we're seeing it start to rise now. And I'm concerned that there are people who are more worried about the economic impact than the potentially tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, and some, by some estimates, millions of lives that could be lost across the country.
I want to remind listeners that you can that you're tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporters and editors from the Salt Lake Tribune. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us. Our handle here is @KCPW. Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, I want to come back to you now. And Is it too much to ask you, you know, basically what we're supposed to be doing right now? I mean, there are limits on gatherings, requests that we stay home, all of this intended to flatten the curve. You know, the spread, the spread will keep happening, but we want to keep it slow so that people who need hospital beds will be able to access them when the time comes. In Utah, what kind of restrictions are there right now? And maybe we could start with those limits on gatherings, Matt.
Yes. So they got a little confused last night. Starting with President Donald Trump, he asked for the next 2 weeks that we don't have gatherings of more than 10 people. And in response to that, Governor Gary Herbert decided to issue the same thing. He put it in the middle of a public health order that shut down dine-in restaurant options. And the counties took that as they needed to follow suit. And so they, Salt Lake County and Utah County, issued similar orders. Do not get in groups of 10 or more. But when they did it, they added a criminal penalty where you could actually be charged with a misdemeanor for being in a group of 10. And that caused a little more panic than the governor wanted. But so he asked them to pull that back. Essentially, this is the deal. Don't get in groups of 10. Don't leave your house unless you need to. Don't have a party. Don't, you know, get close to people at the grocery store when you're getting groceries. Limit your movements. It's a weird crisis when the solution is stay on your couch. But that's where we're at. And it does have huge effects. As I told you, the whole Tribune staff is working remotely. And we talk on phone. We talk through video chats. But people are getting stir crazy. And we're on, like, day three or four here.
Right.
So this is going to get even far more difficult to do going forward when you're told to just isolate yourself from people. And that particularly includes older people.
To protect
from what I've read, about 80% of the people who get the coronavirus have relatively mild symptoms. That doesn't mean it's not a bad cold. It just means it's not worth hospitalization. But for older people, 60 and up, it is much more severe and leads to, it's far more likely to result in a hospitalization, the need for a ventilator, and potentially death. And that's why we're all staying home, is that we don't want to see a rush on hospital rooms to the point where a doctor has to make horrible decisions about who gets one of these ventilators and who does not. And that's what's happened in Italy. Now, I have seen, and it's starting to go away, but early this week, a lot of people thinking this is an overreaction. Today in the Salt Lake Tribune, we had a story that talked about how for the first time, there are more people concerned about the coronavirus than the flu this year. Okay, that's not where it needs to be, but we're making some progress. We should all be concerned because the actions we take can impact others.
I want to put a pause on this conversation again, just press the pause button once more, because we are going to head to another break in the show, and we will pick up the conversation where we left off. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. When we come back, more on the news of coronavirus in Utah. We'll be back in a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning news roundup, heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can weigh in on what you've been listening to by calling 801-355-8255. Or, again, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Picking up where we left off, Matt Canham, we were talking about, you know, social distancing and the importance of staying home and, you know, flattening the curve so that our healthcare system doesn't get overwhelmed. On the topic of social distancing, you know, we've got schools closed, restaurants and bars closed, arts venues, et cetera, a huge impact on the local economy. I guess leaving schools aside for a second, what are officials doing to make a difference for those businesses and, well, for everybody who's suffering on the economic front? You know, so many businesses are taking a big hit right now, and there's almost nothing they can do about it. Matt, what's happening for local relief for businesses?
It's been pretty limited so far. You have cities that are relaxing their rules to allow them to advertise that you can, you know, come in and get a pickup order from a restaurant. That's pretty minor. You have Salt Lake City, who's trying to get together $1 million fund to help small businesses. And there's efforts in that regard that I think we'll see to continue to roll out. The legislature set some money aside, but we're not exactly sure how much this will help the small business. And it's quite possible that the legislative session will come back, or the legislature will come back in a special session for some sort of a relief effort. And then you have the ongoing debates in Washington.
Yeah, and I want to get to that, and maybe we can turn to back to Thomas Burr for the relief that's on the way from the federal government. I mean, there was a package of bills or some measures passed in Washington on that front. Tommy, can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. So we went through phase one, which was just an initial, like, yeah, we've got to do something, to help out hospitals and a few things. We just now the president signed phase two, which is essentially like extending, paid leave and expanding food stamps and now we're moving on to phase three, which is the proposal that, you know, kind of started in some ways with Mitt Romney, part of it at least.
Right.
He wasn't the first one to have this idea, but Mitt Romney on Monday morning suggested that every American adult should get $1,000. It kind of was an influx. Initially, it was going to be, you know, once a month during the crisis. Then it was down to maybe once, maybe again. And this is kind of reverberated around Washington a little bit. At the moment, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's suggestion is a package that, one, deals with some subsidies, some help for the airline industry that's hard hit, maybe more of the hospitality industry, some small businesses. In addition to that, a payment, direct payment, could be a check or a direct deposit to pretty much most Americans. $1,200 for an individual, $2,400 for a married couple, and $500 per dependent child. Now, that's kind of contingent on how much you make. So if you make less than $75,000 a year, that's what you receive. If you make more than that, it tapers off. Anyone making more than $99,000 a year would get nothing. And there's some debate whether this is going to work out and how it will change, because some people suggested there should be a payment in April, maybe a payment in May. Mitt Romney's not happy with this idea right now because there are a lot of Americans that actually don't pay income taxes. They don't make enough money.
Right.
And under this proposal, they'd only get a minimum of $600, whereby other people are going to get $1,200. So there's a lot of negotiations still happening about this, but they want to get it passed quickly. The idea is maybe even by Monday-ish. The Senate's debating it now. The House is going to have to come back in, but there will be more help. In this case, a trillion-dollar bill to try to do something for the economy.
Hmm. A side note on what Congress has been doing. There was this the package that we were just talking about that passed. There was a Utah senator who voted against that package. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Senator Mike Lee voted against what we're calling now Phase 2, and his big concern was there was an amendment by Rand Paul, his buddy from Kentucky, who the senator wanted essentially this package to be paid for, that we shouldn't just be adding on to the national debt. We should be cutting elsewhere in the government if we're going to be spending this money. And that goes along with Senator Lee's point, since he's been in Congress, that we should live beyond our means. And if we're going to spend the money, which he says we should cut elsewhere. The amendment didn't pass, and the final bill came up. It does add to the government's credit card. But as other senators pointed out, if there's a time you add to your credit card, it's when it's an emergency and you have to do it. So at some point, yes, we're adding to the country's debt, but also it kind of needs to happen. So Mike Lee voted against it. Senator Mitt Romney voted for it.
I want to bring in news columnist Robert Gerke. Robert, on that vote, also the proposal from Senator Mitt Romney to, the $1,000 for every adult in the United States and what might be happening there. And I guess just sort of economic, relief attempts being done by governments in general. What do you make of it all?
Well, it needs to be done. I think Senator Romney is right. I think he made a point yesterday as well that it shouldn't be dependent on your income. It should be, the low income people need relief, just like the high earners. But there is a cap. I mean, there should be a cap. We don't need to be giving you know, $1,200 to millionaires in a time of crisis. But his point was that it shouldn't be phased down either. So, you know, it needs to be done. I think Senator Lee, I guess we can't be too surprised by the votes he takes. It's again, probably making a statement rather than actually moving the needle on issues, because, you know, obviously this bill was going to pass. It passed overwhelmingly, I think 90 votes in favor of it. So he's sort of, you know, planting his flag. It sends a bad message, I think. I think it looks like he once again is putting, you know, his principles or his philosophy ahead of, you know, the public welfare and people's lives. And it's, you know, not the vote he should be taking or the message he should be sending. But it's good that they're passing this bill, and hopefully we see some impact from it. I mean, as Matt touched on, there are going to be a lot of people out of work and suffering for the, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I'm not sure that $1,200 or $2,400 or even $4,000, if that's what they end up doing, is going to be enough to really blunt all of that damage, but it maybe will do some good.
Matt Canham, the you know, one way that people have been trying to get relief is from unemployment filings in Utah. There's been a pretty massive uptick in unemployment filings. Is that right?
Yes, it went up more, or roughly 30%, but that was last week. That was before everything shut down. And I think now it's going to be just a significant increase going forward here, because you have all of the seasonal workers, part-time workers. If you worked as a, you know, someone who worked in a restaurant serving tables and you made your money largely on tips, you're in trouble. So I think we're going to see a huge increase in unemployment. Hopefully temporary. Hopefully it's a month or two or whatever long it takes us to get through this crisis. But the impact on those people is huge. The federal government is trying to help out in that way. The state is assuring that they have plenty of money to pay for unemployment benefits and that they encourage everyone to apply. But they need to be patient when they do apply, because so many people are doing it at the same time that it's overrunning the system. So if you need to apply for unemployment benefits, start the process online and know that it's going to be a little bit of a process.
Okay. Can we talk just for a second about the impact to Utah schools, Matt Canham? I know that, you know, obviously schools are closed and there is a lot of packets of information that are being passed out to students to keep their education going. But then food programs as well for people who rely on school assistance to feed themselves. Can you just talk about the sort of general overview of education in, you know, in this bizarre moment that we're living through?
Yes, there's online classes in areas where that's worked. There's packets of homework. All these parents are suddenly becoming homeschool teachers. And if you look on social media, it turns out being a teacher is far harder than many people anticipated, even though we already have a lot of respect for teachers. It's a tough thing to work from home and keep your kids going at the same time. And a lot of people are struggling with that. But for low-income people, one thing that schools also did is it provided meals. So there are school districts that the majority of them are trying to continue to offer a sack lunch and in some places a breakfast as well. That hasn't gone as smoothly as we would have liked so far, but for the most part, it's working. Salt Lake School District was a little overrun yesterday, and it took a donation for them to be able to offer lunches today, but they say they're able to do it. We'll see how this goes going forward, but for some low-income families, those meals were very important.
Hey, Robert Gerke, do you want to weigh in on education in the time of coronavirus?
Well, I think, you know, it just goes to, you know, the disruption this has caused in everybody's lives. And, you know, there's not much option except to close down the schools. And you know, to be frank, my daughter works at a Title I school where she, you know, so she's going to be not only out of work, but a large number of those kids relied on the school for their lunches. They would serve them, you know, a dinner in the after school program. So that's disruptive. One of the sort of inspiring stories I've seen is that there are some of these restaurants who, frankly, are facing a really uncertain future over the next several months. That, you know, whether they're going to survive or not on their own, are stepping up and feeding people who had relied on these relied on these resources in the past. And so it's sort of a heartwarming story, I guess, about how we're pulling together. But yeah, it's there's no question it's going to be disruptive for quite some time.
I just want to read a comment here that we got from a listener who called in and left this comment, didn't stay on the line. Chris from St. George said that essential employees make minimum wage and probably don't have health insurance, and so kudos to them, I guess, at this moment in time. Matt, on the...
Can I just add to something that real fast?
Yeah.
I think one thing that I've taken from this is what is an essential worker.
Right.
That is a broader category than I thought. That's janitors and people who clean our buildings are essential workers. People who work at grocery stores and pharmacies are essential workers. And I think that in normal times, we forget stuff like that.
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, we are just running up here into the final minutes of the show and should probably turn to our underplayed stories of the week. But Robert Gerke, do you want to echo any comments there on essential workers and I guess maybe new realizations in general about how the world operates because of this pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, I think Matt nailed it. I think, I walked into a 7-Eleven yesterday and, you know, you think about it. You don't think about the 7-Eleven guy necessarily, but the grocery store people, all of these people that do the garbage, trash men, you know, it's things that maybe we take for granted in our day-to-day lives, and also just sort of how easily all of this can be blown up. You know, just the disruption that we're facing right now is severe, and it's going to remain that way for quite a while. That's the doom and gloom message I keep giving, but people need to understand that this is not a short-term thing, and we're going to need to pull together.
All right, that's Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been doing the show for more than 7 years, and I can't remember a time when I've more looked forward to this final segment, our underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight something that maybe hasn't been, you know, weighing heavily on everyone's minds, or maybe it's part of the same story. But Matt Canham, do you want to kick us off with an underplayed story?
I am not going to do an earthquake or coronavirus-related story. I'm going to do one about prosecutors in Utah County.
Okay.
They were under investigation because they went to a jazz game with a defense attorney who paid for their tickets. And the legal system is supposed to have prosecutors on the opposite side of defense attorneys, not being your buddy who goes to the jazz game and invites you over for a pool party. These prosecutors said they did nothing wrong. They were being investigated, but they all resigned their jobs. It's an interesting story from Jessica Miller.
All right, check it out at sltrib.com. Thanks, Matt, for that pick. Robert Gerke, I think I might be able to guess what yours is, but your underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, I don't know if it's underplayed because we played it pretty prominently, but former Attorney General John Swallow filed yesterday to run for re-election or election to his former office. John Swallow, you will remember back in 2013, right after he was inaugurated, became the focus of probably one of the state's largest, most widespread political scandals. He ended up driving him out of office in November. He was charged with multiple felonies and then acquitted and received a payment from the state for his legal fees. He said, you know, on his website that he felt like he was brought down by basically a deep state conspiracy, and that he's much like Donald Trump in that regard, and he wants to be vindicated. He was vindicated, and he wants his job back. So now we've got a pretty interesting attorney general's race, because we already had David Levitt, the Utah County prosecutor who oversees the office Matt was talking about, who's jumped into it, and Attorney General Reyes and a couple Democratic candidates. So not just the governor's race this year. We've got an interesting AG's race, including former Attorney General John Swallow.
And, of course, a presidential race on top of that. Thank you, Robert Gerke, for your pick. And we will go back to Thomas Burr in Washington, D.C., your choice for underplayed story of the week.
Hey, thanks. I'm going to jump back to coronavirus just for a second.
That's
because
fine.
We're talking about all the wonderful people who are doing really great things out there, but there's also people doing some things that are questionable. So news today that Senator Richard Burr, no relation to me, by the way, of North Carolina, is hearing all this intelligence about what's happening to coronavirus, privately saying how bad it's going to be, publicly saying, oh, we're prepared. Meanwhile, he's dumping more than $1 million in stocks and at the height of the market before everything starts tanking. Now he's asking for an ethics investigation of himself to try to clear his name. But
it just shows that some people will take advantage of a situation.
Right. Thomas Burr, following news in Washington with his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. For my part, I'm going to go with an audio clip, actually. I was on a press call with Senator Mitt Romney earlier this week. It was a call that Thomas Burr was on as well. Anyway, at the very end of that call, the senator did something that was kind of refreshing to hear and contrasted with some other statements that we've heard coming out of Washington. He thanked the press. Take a quick listen.
I just want to say thank you to all of you. I know that you're working in environments as well where social distance is difficult. But like healthcare workers, there are some people that the state relies on. And the people of our state rely on to know that things are normal. And having you carry messages out lets people know, hey, things are still operating, things are still normal. And I appreciate the fact that you're taking a little higher risk and are serving the public as you are. So thanks much, and we'll keep you updated.
That's my pick for Underplayed Story, Senator Romney's statement to members of Utah media on a press call this week. And that does it for this... Wow, this edition of Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis, our operations director, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan, and to our guests, Thomas Burr, Matt Canham, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for joining today, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Stay safe, everyone. We hope that you remain safe in this interesting time. I hope you're finding a way to make the best of this trying time. Thanks for joining Behind the Headlines.